nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
Welcome, everyone, to Properties of Nanomaterials. Today is the second in a series of six workshops that we are calling Intro to Nanotechnology. So I am presenting. So here, let me move forward. Okay, so this is me. My name is Marielle Kolker. I teach a course called Nanoscale Science and Engineering, and I've been teaching it for about 5 years, and I just was in communication with a student that I taught with my first or second year here, and she changed her degree to materials engineering or materials science when she was in undergrad, and she just emailed me 2 days ago and said that she was pursuing her PhD in nanomedicine. And I was like, oh, this is so amazing. So I'm very excited that we're bringing nanoscience to high schoolers. I also teach physics, and I'm still working on integrating nanoscience into physics. And I'm from New Jersey. And this is, so I'll let Peter introduce himself.
Hi, I'm Peter Kazarnoff. I'm one of the other presenters for today. I'm faculty in engineering and engineering technology at Portland Community College in beautiful Portland, Oregon, where it's foggy and 51 degrees and rainy for the next 2 weeks. I'm also a co-PI on MinTech, which is the Micro Nano Technician Education Center, which is a nationwide center that's leading technician education for the micro and nano industries. And I'm super excited to talk about size and scale with everybody today.
All right. So how small is nanotechnology? For those of you who were here last week, I would like to ask you, what do these things tell you? Who remembers the comparisons? If you want to, please unmute and tell me about one of these, how you frame these in terms of nanoscience.
I think the Earth was compared to, if the Earth was a meter in diameter, then a nanometer would be a marble.
Yes, thank you. Thank you so much. That's exactly right. The Earth would be a marble, which is the one that blows my mind the most of all of them. So thank you, Michelle. Anybody remember how wide a strand of hair is in nanometers?
80,000.
You want to take
80,000.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, 80,000, exactly. 80,000 nanometers wide. And then what is the thing that if you could zoom in, you would see on the penny, on the back of the penny? It's the Lincoln Memorial.
Yeah, but Abe.
Lincoln in a chair.
Lincoln in a chair. And if you zoom into Lincoln, his eyelash would be how wide? It would be 100 nanometers. So it's just so, so, so small. So whatever fits your, you know, helps you understand, that is what we need to do, is take things that are macro scale and just kind of give an analogy to help kids understand how very small it is. Because you can define it as a billionth of a meter, but those are just words. It doesn't really, we humans have a hard time understanding powers of 10 on that magnitude. The DNA is there because DNA is, anyone remember how many nanometers wide it is?
40.
Smaller. It's 2.5 nanometers wide when it's uncurled. 2.5 nanometers wide. So let's go on. Let's move on now. So, let's see if I can get this to go. Okay, so here we go. So this is something that is written into the framework for K-12 science education, which is the basis for next-gen science standards. Those words might not mean something to you if you are not a K-12 teacher, but it is a masterful document that talks about really reframing education of students to focus on, really the big ideas. And one of those big ideas big ideas. And one of them is scale, proportion, and quantity. And nanoscale speaks directly to that. So it is very relevant, and it doesn't matter which science it is that you teach. This is a broad topic that students all need to understand. So the property changes with scale that we're going to be going over today are light matter interactions, gravity, the fact that gravity becomes insignificant. It doesn't disappear because you can't cancel a force, but it becomes so small as compared to intermolecular forces that it just kind of loses its meaning. Surface effects become extremely important due to large surface area of as compared to volume. And because of that, motion becomes very complicated. And lastly, quantum effects dominate. Peter, you're going to have to remind me when I'm supposed to. I think I just blasted straight past your slides.
So, Mariel, you're doing awesome. And I'm also going to monitor the chat. So if anybody has questions while Mariel's going through or I'm presenting, you can stick them in the chat and we'll try to make sure that we get to them.
Great. Okay. So you have to remind me when I have to stop. I think I'm taking this unit. You take the next one.
Yeah. Right. So are there any questions so far with what we've got?
Okay.
So I don't see anything in the chat, Mira. Yeah, let's continue on.
Okay. So light matter interactions at the nanoscale are fascinating, and they're really fun because for students they really struggle with it. So blue, there's an issue with blue with regard to nanoscale. So Mother Nature has a hard time making blue. You will see that it's really easy to make reds. Red is iron. We know that, right? And greens and pinks and all the other colors, and not blue. I mean, the sky is blue, but that's not, it's not, we know that the gases aren't blue. It's the way the light is refracted as it comes in. So, however, we have blue, right? Blue exists in our world, but these organisms do not have any blue pigment at all. None at all. Even humans with their blue eyes. So unlike red, yellow, and brown pigments and green, which are made through chemistry, it's incredibly difficult for nature to assemble blue pigments. So where do they come from? Where does this blue come from? It is called structural color. So we have right here, which is a blue morpho butterfly. It is actually a brown butterfly, but the way it interacts with light is at the nanoscale. And the reaction that happens is that we see this blue color. So if we zoom in, we see that there are these scales. So you can see on the right-hand side, the scales, if you zoom in even more, you see they have these ridges on them. And then the ridges, if you zoom in, have these incredibly small structures, these very, very detailed nanostructures. Each one of these trees, so if you look at the cross section, it kind of looks like a tree. So who here knows why I have that question up there? What is the in the 400 to 700 nanometer range why is that
significant? Visible light.
Yes, thank you, Rich. Visible light, right? So visible light. So what happens is it's just the right size to grab hold of some wavelengths, and I'll show you what happens and to change them. So when light reflects, what are we looking at here, physics teachers? We have on the red side, you have certain kind of interference going on, and on the right, you have a different kind of interference going on. Anybody want to call that out?
Constructive and destructive.
Yeah, exactly. So this is actually something that can pop right into your lesson for light at the high school level. So in addition to the material that it's made of actually being brown in nature, because those butterflies are brown, so the brown absorbs some of the color, but then the color that gets reflected cancels. It just cancels. And it's an amazing thing that nature has figured out how to do. And the blue is reflected. So you get this, not just blue, but you get an iridescent blue, which is what you notice with some of the other things. So this is, as I said, straight out of the physics textbook.
So Mariel, we've got some questions in the chat. So Randy asks, what about blueberries? Do you know about blueberries? Do they have structural color or do they have pigment due to chemistry?
I don't know, but I believe that it might be structural. I suspect it might be structural. I do know that that our eyes are actually brown, but the structures make them blue. You can see the iridescence on the butterfly, and also on the beetle, right? The butterflies are brown. These feathers are also brown. So, I mean, I'm just going to straight up guess. I think it's probably structural, but I can't say for sure.
And then another question was from Kendra, and that's about blue bonnets. Do you know if blue bonnets are structural color?
You know, so the one thing I do know that is blue pigment, there's one type of a moth that is brown with blue stripes on it. And I forget the name of it, but it is actually, has blue pigment on it, but it's one out of all the varieties of butterflies and moths that exist. So it's not that nature hasn't, that it doesn't exist. There are blue pigments that do exist, and we do see them in, I guess, in paints, right? But these are much more prevalent in nature. So I don't know all of them, but I do know that this is an amazing thing that nature has come up with to differentiate itself.
Great. Thanks, Mariel. Yeah.
Can I chime in? Blueberries are high in anthocyanin. And if you look at most organisms that contain anthocyanin, they tend to be darker colors, pomegranates, blueberries, red cabbage, radicchio. They all tend to produce those blue to purple colorations. So it may be more than just structural in the case of the blueberries.
Nice. Very, very nice. Actually, anthocyanin is something I use to make dye-sensitized light solar panels. Anthocyanin is very good in combination with titanium dioxide. That's a kit that you can actually buy, and you can make those in your classroom. You're absolutely right. Thank you so much for that. See, I don't have any biology background at all. So this
Mariel, is- yes. Do you think because blue is the smallest, I guess, wavelength out of that visible light spectrum, that it has to do with the angular?
What I've read, so good question, Angel, thank you. What I have read is that actually it's kind of the opposite. So it has to do with band gap. And the band gap, so it's not so much that it's reflecting blue as it is absorbing reds. And red has a very small band gap. It's a very specific small band gap. And it's very difficult for materials to be as precise chemically to absorb certain very small band gap materials. So this is what I've read about it, is that it's easy for it to absorb the high bandwidth, but the band gap is hard to absorb the small band gap. So we're going to get to that later on with quantum dots, and Peter's going to talk about that in a little bit. But let me move on. So, I love these conversation questions. This is fantastic. Am I still presenting, Peter? Am I still my thing?
You are still presenting.
Okay, great. So who knows why stained glass, what is stained glass made of? Do we know if you have any idea what creates these colors? You can go ahead and unmute. Okay, this is has been around for much longer than any of us has been around. So nanotechnology is a new science, but the people have been using nanotechnology for centuries. So this is Lycurgus cup that was created in the 5th century of the Common Era. It contains gold, silver, and copper nanoparticles up to 100 nanometers. And you can see, because of the way that they interact with light, when the light is on the outside of the cup looks green. And when the light is on the inside of the cup looks pink or red, which was definitely, you know, a deliberate effect. And it is these gold, silver, and copper nanoparticles that actually give it this effect. So we have since come to understand that gold at different nanometer sizes of the particles will reflect different colors because of the way that they interact with the light. There's energy that the electrons on the surface can take. And because of the small size, smaller than the wavelength of light, the electrons are limited to the amount of light that they can reflect. So the smallest are red, and then larger ones are green, and then even larger ones at 100 nanometers are orange. And the same thing is true for silver, but silver has different colors. So the largest ones are yellow, the smaller ones are blue, and then if you change it to a triangle, they're red, which is beautiful and amazing. And so that is when you look at stained glass, you know, we don't really think about it. I never thought about it until I started teaching nanoscience. But when you look at stained glass, you're actually looking at all of these metals, which is amazing. And I've got a vial of red nanoparticles just sitting on my desk at all times, just to get kids interested and curious. So so gold nanoparticles in particular are very interesting. There's an explosion of use in with regard to medicine and nanomedicine, because you can do so much more with them than just make stained glass. There are all kinds of surface things that can be bound to the surface, and because of this, you can use them. They're inert, and they're absolutely inside the human body. They're inert. So you can put all kinds of things on them. You can put dyes on them, or you can put targeted enzymes on them. You can deliver drug with them. My favorite is just putting photothermal therapy. One of the first things that doctors were doing with this was sensitizing the particles with surface material that would adhere to tumors. And then once they cut the gold particles on the tumor, they just sent light, infrared or UV light into the body. And it just warms it up the same way that the sun warms up your car in the summer. And because it's metal, it will warm up, and then it actually kills the tumor. So it's amazing what all the different ways in which they're being used in medicine right now. So right now, just if you were here last week, you saw that that all of the tests seem to be all nanotechnology. So these nanoparticles, as you just learned, when you change the size of them, you change the color of them. So these nanoparticles were coated in a surface material that was sensitive to COVID virus. When they are in the presence of the virus, they aggregate, come together, and adhere to one another, and it changes the size of the particle. And then when the particle is changed to a different size, it appears red instead of clear or maybe blue. And because of that, you have like this rapid response. It's a rapid test. So the rapid test, you can actually just look at it. You don't have to look at it under a microscope or put it in some kind of a test. You can just look at it, which is what made it a rapid test. And also for the testing of the antibodies in your system, this gold nanoparticles are also used in this regard too. As you can see, there's gold nanoparticles with things attached to them, bound to them. So with a conjugate attached to it, and then that actually provides you with these indicators. So there's a lot going on with nanoscience right now.
Mariel, in the chat, John asks that gold's inert in the human body. Does gold accumulate, or is it flushed out by our systems?
Right. Really good question. And it's a very difficult question to answer, because there's a whole area of ethics in nanotechnology and nanoscience, because we don't really know. Nanoparticles of this magnitude are small enough to go inside our cells, and they certainly can cross over the blood-brain barrier into your brain. When they put them in your blood to be delivered to a tumor, they sensitize the surface to look for and adhere to where the tumor is. We don't have any, because they're so much smaller than cells, we don't really know what happens, whether they are able to be flushed out of your system or not. And then even in that case, there are ethical considerations, because then if they're going into the sewer system, there's no filter small enough to catch them. And then they're going into our water supply, which means that eventually they're coming back. So this is so you've perhaps inadvertently, but you've touched on the broad field of ethics and nanotechnology, which as these things become more, these proliferate in our water system, and in our health systems, this is going to be a bigger and bigger issue. I think because these are not going into the body, but the ones for tumor, I think what the doctors are, I mean, I think they're doing trials, and I think that it's, well, we got to cure you of cancer before we worry about the nanoparticles. I think that that's where it is right now. But there's a larger question, which is what are we really doing here? So it's a very good question. Thank you for asking. All right, so we're on to quantum dots, and I believe that Peter's going to take it from here.
Yeah, so I'm Peter, and I'm so glad everybody is here. We've got 34 participants total, and so far the questions have been great. So please keep those questions coming. We want to keep the session interactive. So you can see here a bunch of different quantum dots. Quantum dots are inorganic nanoparticles, and UV light was shined on these vials, which contained quantum dots. And depending on both the size and the shape of the quantum dot, different wavelengths of light will then be emitted. And we call this process fluorescence. Can you go on to the next one, Mary?
I gave you your control back.
Oh, we're being fancy. So all of these quantum dot vials take in the same wavelength of blue light. And in this picture, we're showing a wavelength of light that's 450 nanometers. Now, each one of the spheres there in the middle of the picture represents a quantum dot of a different size in nanometers. So on the left-hand side, we've got a quantum dot that is 2 nanometers in size. And then all the way on the right-hand side, we've got a quantum dot which is 6 nanometers in size. And all of these quantum dots are absorbing the same wavelength of light. But the emitted light, the fluoresced light, is a different color. And so that gives us the ability to tune the color of emitted light all across the visual spectrum. So why does this happen? Why can you get different color out of quantum dots if you put the same color in? Well, I'm going to explain this with the concept of band gap that Mariel talked about earlier. So in materials, electrons in a low energy state are in what's called the valence band. And I like to think of the valence band like the lower cabinets in your kitchen. The valence band is those cabinets that are below the countertop. And I like to think of the electrons as cans of soup or cans of tomatoes that are down in those lower cabinets. And at a ground state, those cabinets are filled up with all those cans. But when we shoot our blue light onto the nanoparticles, that is like energizing our cook to grab one of those cans from the bottom cabinet and reach up and put it up on a top cabinet. But our top cabinets, they're like a little tippy, and the cans fall right back down onto the counter, splat. And so that fall down from the top cabinet, which we call the conduction band, back down to the counter, the top of the valence band, is why we get different wavelengths of light emitted by our quantum dots. So our red quantum dot, those top cabinets are a little bit closer to the counter. Our green quantum dot, those top cabinets are a little bit further away from the counter. And then those blue quantum dots, that's somebody that's got a real fancy 10-foot ceiling kitchen, and the top cabinets are real high up above. And we can't put our cans of soup or our cans of tomatoes anywhere in between the countertop and those top cabinets. If we do, it'll just fall right back down to the counter. And that's because that region in between the countertop and those top cabinets, that is called the band gap. So we use quantum dots in a number of different applications. And on the left-hand side here, I'm showing a quantum dot television. You can buy these right now at Costco. And they've got tuned quantum dots of different sizes and shapes in order to make incredibly vibrant colors coming out of the television. And they can also make these TVs incredibly thin, also with very small side bezels. And in the center, this is a COVID-19 home test, which is being proposed by a company that you could just do at your house. You wouldn't have to have the test sent over to a lab. And it also uses quantum dot technology in order to show whether somebody at home is infected with COVID-19 or not. And then on the right-hand side, we can just see a comparison of the size of a typical quantum dot, possibly around 10 nanometers, as compared to the size of a white blood cell, which could be in the 10,000 nanometer kind of range, or the size of a water molecule. And that's within the like 0.1 nanometer range, or the one micron size scale range. So let's take a quick break. We're at 7:93. Does anyone have any questions before we move on and talk about forces?
I want to honor that the time that you're going to get in small groups, because that's so much how we often learn. So so I just was kind of tongue in cheek here with the force. May the force be with you. So what we have here is, as we all know, our physics teacher is the four forces that we know about in the universe so far, the strong and weak, which are internuclear. And then there's the gravity and electromagnetism, which are at distance. And we know that with gravity, the mass is so small for nano-sized objects, the gravity becomes insignificant. So let me be clear, it does not disappear. We don't stop having gravity. We can't turn that off, but it's insignificant as compared to the electrostatic force, which is orders of magnitude stronger, particularly with objects that are at the nanoscale. So what that means is, for example, for our chemistry teachers here, for a colloid, we know that at some point, if you make particles small enough, inside a liquid, they will no longer settle. So if they don't settle, they are actually being supported by this kind of network of, like say, for example, milk. You've got the lipid particles inside water. So the water has these really strong hydrogen bonds that are holding each molecule next to the next molecule, and it supports the particles because the gravity just is too small. So what turns out is that you can teach this in terms of nanoscience. So the question is, why don't they settle? And this is the answer. So colloidal, sometimes you will see between 1 and 100 nanometers, and sometimes you'll read it as 1 to 1,000 nanometers, but it's still the same concept, which is that if it's large enough the suspension will be unstable and it will settle. And if it's colloidal, you still have those particles. And I do an activity and with this and the Tyndall effect, where you can tell that it's a colloid, you can tell light is bouncing off the particles, but they are too small to settle. And so that really shows in a nice way that nano is really all about the absence of, or gravity not being significant anymore. So, you know, that's all nice and well, but like until you start thinking about, well, where can I see it that's really is really going to show me? And this is the Tokay gecko, which is amazing. It is hanging upside down on a piece of glass. If you've not seen this before, this is just an amazing thing. They don't have sticky feet. Their feet are dry, but they harness forces at the nanoscale in order to do what they do. So let me show you how that works. So first, this is a GIF from Stanford. When you zoom into that foot, you get these hairs. And at the end of each hair, we've got these tiny, on the nanoscale, spatulae. So let's watch it again. It zooms in. I guess it doesn't do it if I do it the second time. Oh, there it goes. Let's go back. All right, zooms in, and then you see the hairs, and the hairs even are broken up into more. It's kind of almost like a, it just keeps going, right? It just keeps splitting and splitting and splitting. So we know that when we, physics teachers that teach friction, you put your hand down on the surface, there's so many places where there's actually no contact, right? That your hand does not really come into tremendous contact because of all the different ups and downs on the surfaces that you're putting together. And that's where coefficient of friction comes into play. Well, because of these incredibly small nanoscale, these little hairs, setae and spatulae, they actually come in contact. And you can see at the end, it's actually a wider surface. So it's an absolute maximization of surface to surface contact. And what that does is, because you have so much contact, it's the same kind of effect as like if you're rubbing a balloon on your hair and then you hang it on the wall. There's an induced charge on the wall, and then that allows the forces to hold. And because there's so much of this going on, it multiplies to make a force that is actually sufficient for supporting the weight of the gecko. So what we see here is, you know, we don't really think about it when we look at a beetle or an ant, because we've seen them upside down and on the walls and everything, right? And even spiders. No, I never stopped to think about the fact that how can they support their weight? Because they're so small. But then when you get the gecko's not really small, right? It's doing this magic trick for us. So it's this amazing ability to stick to the surface, nothing sticky about it. But if you notice, if we look onto the feet, these are scanning electron microscope images of all of these feet, they all have that same property, which is that enlarged surface area at the end of each one of these nano hairs. And so what we're looking at is, you know, a maximization of surface to surface contact. So it doesn't start to you know, make us go, wow, how did they do that, until they get to be big enough. So I have a question for you. We're going to put you into random groups. I'm going to ask you to do a little bit of math today. So we have, this is something that I do in my classroom. Let's just have some fun with it and see if we can come up with how big. So how big, if you had those same hairs on your hands, those same, they're called setae, and then also spatulae at the end of the setae. If you had those on your hands, how large would your hands have to be to support you? So a tokay gecko, which weighs, you know, less than a pound, can suspend by just one of its feet. And that it has a surface area of 0.008 meters squared. If you weigh, let's just make the answers all come together at the end, we're going to say that 180 pounds. So if we want to support someone that's 180 pounds, how big would your hand have to be in square meters to hold you up? So, and then when you come back to the group, how big is that as measured in cookie sheets? So one cookie sheet is about 0.15 meters squared. So we're going to put you in groups. We're going to put this question into the chat so that you'll be able to see it while you're in the groups. And we're going to give you about 10 minutes to figure that out and come back to us. If you, the three people in your group have no interest whatsoever in doing any math today, that's okay. You can talk about potential uses for mastering this natural nanotechnology, because we have scientists that are actually pursuing this with biomimicry. So this is the design that they came up with. So it's a synthetic adhesion system with four of these plates, and each plate has tiles on it that are, if you see the springs, they're spring loaded so that you can actually engage and disengage. And so they put two on the feet, two on the hands. And then I think there were others down at the bottom where the rollers, I'm not sure, but he was able to actually climb the wall. Yeah, see, there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of these tiles. And they were able to use this to scale the wall, which is amazing. So if you want to look more closely, we look more closely into the science of it. So here, lower left is the right, lower right is the plate with the tiles on it. And then if you go to your left, now we're at the center, you see it says 100 micrometers. That is actually PDMS, which is a type of plastic that's very easy. It's very easy to get really, to cut it or to form it in extremely small structures. It holds those structures really well. So these are the kind of the surfaces, right? And you can see they're on an angle. So when it applies to the glass, it actually, the angles all kind of lay down and they maximize surface area. And then when you pull, it actually, they go back to their shape, and then it's just the tips or the ends that are on surface. So that was what they used. On the top, you see with the red squares, you see the actual, the natural version of this, the gecko's version of this. And you can see very interestingly that as the surface area decreases and you move to the left, the adhesive shear stress increases, which is amazing, right? So that that, as we were saying, the physiology of the gecko itself, that it's able to increase the number of these little spatulas that, you know, the spatulae that are holding on, that are in contact with the surface. So they actually become stronger as they become smaller. They were able to achieve a small amount of that with the blue line, which was the synthetic adhesion system, a very small slope, but an increase. So we're looking into this. And did anybody in anybody's group come up with an application, something that could be useful for someone to be able to climb walls other than being Super Spider-Man? Can we try that again? I know it's awkward with Zoom, but go ahead and unmute.
I was thinking new kind of Velcro.
Oh, a new kind of Velcro. Okay. That's interesting. That's an interesting idea. Anybody else?
I was thinking if you could get something that climbed, you could build, like, you know, you could have those small nanobots just climbing and climbing and spinning a nano generator to create electricity.
Oh, wow. That's an interesting idea. Great. These are really interesting.
I don't know if it's been realistic.
It's interesting.
I was thinking of all the windows we have in the world.
Yeah.
If you could put a coating where they're so, you know, so small, you could still see through your windows. They wouldn't affect vision. And these things just kept moving up and up and up and up and up and over, you know, like, in a circular pattern, they could.
So there's so many. Can you imagine giving this to your kids and being like, think of an idea for this, right? This is an amazing, wonderful thing. You know, some of the other things that you could think of are perhaps nanobots or just regular macro-sized robots that could be navigating spaces that are, you know, difficult to get to. You could make this small robots that can climb on any surface that could go and search for survivors in an earthquake, right? Something like that. So being able to get into spaces that we can't get into ourselves. So many great applications of this. So
a lot of medical applications, I think.
Amazing. Amazing. So we have more things to share with you. Super hydrophobicity is another one. So I'm going to turn this back over to Peter. Peter, are you ready?
Yeah. So you can see here that we have a lotus leaf. This green picture, that's a lotus leaf. And nature uses nanostructures for more than hanging geckos and insects upside down. The lotus leaf is in environments where it's very, very rainy, just like Portland, Oregon, where I am. And the structure on the surface of a lotus leaf makes it a super hydrophobic surface. So that word super hydrophobicity means a surface that is very repellent to water. So let's take a look at another example of super hydrophobicity. So this is a tile coated with a product called Neverwet, and you can get it at Home Depot or on Amazon. And the water stands up on the portion of the tile on the outside that has the Neverwet coating, and it just runs into the rest of the green water that's at the center where there's no Neverwet coating. So we can mimic the same effect of the lotus leaf on something like a bathroom tile or commercial tile using a commercial product like Neverwet. And this is an example of two gentlemen, one whose clothes are coated in this Neverwet product that's on the left-hand side. And you can see that that gentleman gets all muddy. And then on the right-hand side, that is a gentleman whose clothes have been coated with Neverwet. And you can see that the mud splashes all over the wall behind him, but his clothes stay relatively clean. And I just love the way that the one gentleman looks at the other afterwards, like right there.
The guy that's dry is laughing. And so it's just, you can't share super hydrophobicity with your students and not share this, because this is hilarious.
So if we zoom into the surface of the lotus leaf using an SEM, and SEM stands for scanning electron microscope that we were talking about earlier, you can see these little bumps. And these little bumps in the left-hand image, those aren't on the nanoscale. You can see a scale bar of 10 UM, 10 microns. So those are kind of in roughly the size range of like human hairs, smaller than hairs, but that same kind of magnitude. But if we zoom in closer in the middle image, we can see that there's structures on top of those bumps. And then if we zoom in even more, the structure on the right-hand image, we can see these wax tubules, and those are at the nanoscale. And that's what produces this super hydrophobic effect in the lotus leaf.
Yep. So I'm going to speak about the next two slides. So I, in teaching the nanoscale science and engineering course, always do Magic Sand, which is everyone's favorite. The labs in this class are so much fun, but it's real science but they love it. So I greatly enjoy this. So what I did was I gave them, it's a little bit of, magic sand, a little bit of regular sand, some water. Tell me what's happening here. I gave you the structure. So silicon is what the sand is made of. And you've got pictures, diagrams on the left and the right that show you really kind of what's going on the surface there. And I didn't share that with my students. I just said, here's the phenomenon. I had shared with them a ton of videos about polar and nonpolar, and about how things interact with one another, and how the hydrogen bonding works, and all of that. So I led them up to it, and then I said, "Here's the phenomenon." And so, if any of you do next gen science standards, phenomena are now we're learning the best way to communicate this information to your students. So you show them this amazing thing that's happening in nature. In this case, it's not nature; it's Arbor Scientific or Amazon or whatever you order it. But it is like magic. And, as we all know, magic is a lot of magic is just science. So we show it to them, and then we're like, here's a phenomenon, and here's what we know about the way you know, polar and nonpolar interact. And so you tell us what's happening. And so I gave them just what, you know, the sand and the water. And then I did not give them these actual pictures. What you see on the left is hydroxyl groups bonded to the silicon on the surface of this, of the sand drawn in. And those are of course polar, which is, as is water. And so they, you know, so sand wet, sand gets very wet because of that. On the right-hand side, you see there's a nonpolar, molecule that is bonded through an oxygen double bond, a single bond, but it's oxygen has both of those open. And so it's bonded to the surface of the silicon. And what it does is it creates this like dome of nonpolar on the surface. And so that's actually what forces the water. So what's fun about that is I gave it to them and I said, hey, you tell me what's happening. And you want to go to the next slide? This is what they gave back. So this is an example of a model. Oh, well done, because you had given me control and I didn't realize it. So this is amazingly what they gave me back, which was so beautiful. They, you know, we talked about the fact that it was siloxane that was it's trimethyl silanol, which is the material, which they looked up. And so they drew on a macro scale, like, you know, visually the sand. And then you can see there's a little gap in that center circle. There's a gap of air. So the water is to the right, the sand is to the left, and there's a little bit of air in between, which actually you can see when you look at the sand underwater. And they actually gave me that that representation of how it's bonding, how this molecule is bonding to the surface of the sand, which I was so proud of. I was so very, very excited about that. So, you know, this is amazing. Explanatory modeling is amazing because they're putting it together and making sense of things on their own. So I could talk about that for hours. I'm not going to, but this is a way that you can really truly integrate it into your classroom, a chemistry classroom, you know, when you're doing polar and nonpolar. Back to you, Peter. Oh, you're muted?
Thank you. So a way we can measure how hydrophobic or how hydrophilic a surface is by measuring something which is called the contact angle. And this is the angle that a drop forms on the surface of a material. So in the upper left-hand image, you can see a hydrophilic surface. And this has a relatively small contact angle. An example of a surface like this could be a very clean glass surface. And if you put a drop of water on it, it's going to spread out. Below that image, we see something called absolute wetting, where the contact angle is theoretically 0 degrees. So that would be like if we only have one molecule thick all along the surface. And so the angle that's produced is 0 degrees. On the far right-hand upper image, you can see an example of a hydrophobic surface, like maybe one of those never wet tile surfaces. And this shows a contact angle, which is greater than 90 degrees. So that would denote a hydrophobic surface, a surface that is water disliking. My kids tell me not to say hate. And then below that, on the lower right-hand side, you see an example. If theoretically only one molecule from that drop touched the surface, then you'd have a contact angle of 180 degrees. So we can call surfaces in a qualitative way hydrophilic and hydrophobic, but we can also describe these surfaces in a quantitative way by measuring their contact angle. So if you're teaching physics or you're teaching chemistry and you want to talk about a competition of either energy terms or force terms, water contact angle is a great way to illustrate that. So the equation on the upper left-hand side is called Young's equation, and it relates the three different energy terms in the system, as well as the contact angle. So I'll just go over this real quick. One of these terms, the sigma SV, that's due to the surface vapor interface. Another term, the one on the lower right-hand side, sigma SL, that's due to the surface liquid interface. And then another energy term on the upper right-hand side, sigma LV, that's the liquid vapor interface. And there's a competition among those three terms, which will determine the contact angle. And a device which measures a contact angle is called a goniometer, which I think is a fun word to say. I used to live up in Seattle, and Boeing uses goniometers when they build the 787 Dreamliner, which is made out of high-strength, low-weight carbon fiber. And they put this device onto the carbon fiber parts, and then these drops of water get spit out of the device, and they measure the diameter of the drops in order to back out the contact angle to know whether that carbon fiber part has been properly prepared for the next step in the airplane building process. So this is an example of hydrophilicity. So this material is sodium polyacrylate. And does anybody in the chat know what common item sodium polyacrylate is in?
Fake snow.
Fake snow's one. Yeah.
Diapers. And then
diapers. Yeah. If you've got little kids. So this is the material, one of the materials that's in diapers that absorbs water. So these particles of sodium polyacrylate are very, very small. They have really high surface area, and they can absorb an enormous amount of water. And if you pour water in a beaker filled with sodium polyacrylate, the particles will swell in volume and it'll look sort of like a volcano eruption, but it's not wet. You can sweep these up with a regular broom afterwards. And this is due to the chemical surface on these sodium polyacrylate particles, and that they have a hydrophilic nature. They're water loving. And sodium polyacrylate is also really cheap if you want to get it for your classroom because it's so widely used. So next, Mariel's going to talk about a bunch of different applications that we could use hydrophilic or hydrophobic surfaces.
Yeah, so as you can see, you know, on the top right, you see, you know, obviously we want to protect our phones, right, from water. Everyone, we all know that because we've all been there. Of course, we've got diapers here. Never Wet is amazing. I encourage everyone to try it out. It's just phenomenal. But, you know, other than just being cool and saving your phone, you know, all electronics, you can coat electronics with these surfaces in order to protect them. You see the pipes down below. You can avoid rust if you can avoid contact with, if you can cover something and prevent water from being able to touch it. And then you've got on the top left, that's a catheter and with a device that a balloon that inserts it. And for things that go inside the body, keeping moisture away from them means that you can prevent bacterial growth, which is tremendously important when you're doing, when you're sharing from, when you're putting things inside a body. Okay, let's see if I'm connected now. Okay, surface area to volume ratio is, I think, the second to last thing we're going to share with you today. And this has got some fun implications as well. I'm going to move on in the interest of time, if that's okay with everyone. But if you continue to have questions, put them in the chat, please. So surface area to volume ratio is something that becomes, we don't really notice it in the macro world. It doesn't really mean much. to us. But when you get to the very small end of things, most of the material, the more you slice it and dice it, the more you grind it down, the more of the material is actually on the, oh wait, it's on the surface. And Peter, I think this is you. Is this you?
Yeah.
I'm going to stop talking now.
Like Mariel said, next we're going to dig into surface area to volume ratio. And this is just a simple example. If you're teaching size and scale and teaching about dimensions, that you can talk about the difference between volume and area. So on the left, this 1 meter by 1 meter by 1 meter cube has got 6 cubic meters of surface area. And if we go to the right-hand image, we slice it and dice it. If you've only got 1/4 meter cubes, that same original volume will be 24 meters squared of surface area. So Mariel, can you move us on?
Oh, yeah, I can also give it back to you, but okay.
So you could also do this with your class with spheres and calculate the area of a sphere and the surface area of the sphere. And what we see in the plot on the right-hand side is as we decrease the diameter or the radius of the sphere, we increase the surface area. And this will increase our surface area to volume ratio.
Dramatically. Right.
By quite a bit. Yeah. So next, Mariel's going to talk about how surface area to volume ratio figures into biology.
Yeah. So the thing that I discovered, a lot of the reading that I was doing regarding surface area to volume ratio was coming out of biology. And as I started to look, the information that was coming at me was, we have very, very large objects in our universe or on our planet. Very, very large living objects and very, very, very small living objects. And they all seem to have about the same cell size. And why is this? And what could that possibly be causing that? And what biologists know, those of us who are chemistry and physics and nano, not biology, is that there is an optimal ratio between the amount of mass or matter that's inside the cell and the amount of surface area that the inside of the cell can use to exchange, take food in and then expel waste. And so when you have a cell that is too large, there's not enough surface to get all of the food in to feed the cell and not enough surface to then also expel any wastes. So that is inefficient and the cell will die. And then on the smaller end, you have the whole entire cell is a nucleus and there's nothing else going on in the cell because you have too much surface area and not enough material on the inside. So like Goldilocks, we are in the center. And so the ratio of, the amount of space, the amount of material that's inside the cell is optimized for the amount of surface area so that it can breathe. It can breathe and it can eat and it can expel things and it can actually survive. And that is why the size of cells is virtually identical from the very largest of our mammals and our animals to the very smallest, which is kind of cool. So nature already understands this. So now we are we're learning it ourselves. We're now like, oh, okay. Yeah, so back to you, Peter, or is this me?
If you could talk about the catalysts.
Okay, so then we also know that, in the prior slide when we talked about chopping something up into smaller pieces, as you get smaller, more of the material is on the surface of the product of the object, and so therefore you have faster reaction rates, and you also can also works for catalyzing when something is intended to be a catalyst. The smaller it is, the more surface area you have, the better it is at catalyzing. For example, inside a muffler on a car, right? The exchange with the capturing of the carbon with the platinum works best when the platinum is as small as possible. Also, you saw with the stuff that was in the diaper, the sodium polyacrylate, if you can get those in really large pieces, but it goes much, much slower. And the smaller those pieces are, the faster it just kind of sucks up the water. So there's definitely a relationship there for chemistry as well. Oh, sorry. Okay, and Peter?
So on the right-hand side, you can see an image of sodium chloride particles. That's table salt. And if you vary the surface area to volume ratio of table salt, you can change the saltiness of foods. So on the left-hand side, we've got these little white blocks, and those represent a particle of table salt. And if the particles are small, they could cover maybe four different taste buds all at the same time. But if you've got the particle of salt, which is very large relative to the total mass of salt in the food, you aren't going to cover up as many taste buds. So in most packaged foods, the salt particles are very small so that you can get the maximum amount of salt taste for the lowest amount of salt intake. And this is an example of using magnetic nanoparticles for oil recovery. And the black in the image on the left, this is oil. And then the magnetic nanoparticles are the little white dots. And they can grab onto the oil and pull it out of the rock in shale sands.
And the smaller they are, the more they can pull. Yeah, exactly. All right. So this is where I'm going to try and touch you for a bit, because this is my pet peeve. These little nanobots that can navigate around in your blood, that's not a thing. Motion becomes really complicated at the nanoscale. And it has to do with Reynolds number. What you see here is, an image. And this is ubiquitous. It's everywhere. But it's not real. So let me show you what is real. Reynolds, and I'm going to pick it up a little bit so that we have enough time for the time that you guys are going to be spending in your second breakout, which I think is a valuable activity. So Reynolds number, if you're not familiar with it, is the ratio of inertial forces to viscous forces in fluids and how things move through them. So how they move. So you can compare laminar flow, which would be like honey. If you pour honey, it would be very smooth in the way that it moves. Whereas turbulent flow, if you ever pour water, you pour a lot of water, not a little stream of water, but a lot of water, you get this kind of funny shaped, path because there's a lot going on there. And Reynolds number is relative. It's the size of your object moving through as compared to the water. So large ships and large blue whales, they have very, very large Reynolds number, which means that they have absolutely no, a blue whale can flap its tail once and go cruising through the water tremendously easily because it has a lot of inertia and the inertia pushes it forward. A ship can power itself and then turn its engine off and keep coasting for miles because it has a lot of inertia. The thing that's universally true of these bacteria, the smaller size, is that the inertia is almost completely non-existent, or it's so small it's insignificant. In the same way that gravity is so small, it becomes insignificant. So then viscous forces dominate. And what happens when viscous forces dominate is, well, it's like this. Like it's bacteria moving through water is like you trying to swim through a tar pit. You would move as you swam, and then when you tried to move to bring the other arm up, you'd move yourself back, and you just wouldn't get anywhere. We can't move in things that are too sticky. So nature has absolutely accommodated for this and figured it out once again. So this is what we have discovered for motion of things at the nanoscale. You cannot paddle. You cannot do any kind of a crawl. You need to use different means. So the thing on the left is that's just a CG image of a flagella in that corkscrew motion, and the corkscrew actually works really nicely to move through extremely viscous fluids. And the thing on the left is just this little creature that's in the Norwegian, off the Norwegian waters. It's a little flagella, you know, powered thing that is pretty beautiful and amazing, but it's learned how to figure out how to move in these really high viscous environments, or really what we call low Reynolds number environments. So this is a lab that I developed out of one of the University of California schools that had posted online about Reynolds number and Stokes law. Stokes law is how particles move through laminar flow. And I do it with the kids. They really enjoy it. And it's created at it's like a first or second year college level course, a lab. And so I modified it for K-12, but it's interesting. And they really do get into some of these really nice equations and kind of see what they measure. We test to see if Stokes' law applies. So the implications of this are that you can create these beautiful nanoscale, things like gold nanoparticles, or this is a DNA cage where this, you know, inert DNA is configured to actually make a cube. And then scientists can actually put medicines inside the cube and then they become released when they get to the place that they are sensitized to get to, like the tumor or the cancer site or the place where the medication is needed. And that's all wonderful, but how do scientists deliver them? Do you have any ideas how they deliver medications? Anybody want to unmute? And nice. So functionalizing is that image that we had before with the gold nanoparticle with all of those things on the outside, whether you put enzymes on the end, or you can put DNA on the end, you can put things on the end that are sensitized to a certain thing. And that's absolutely what they do. In this case, you can see this, you have these lipid-like molecules that are released, which is in a functional way when this little package arrives at its destination. Yeah, because some tumors will have particular pH on them, which tells the lipids to be released. But the thing is, you can't make these move. So what we have to do is we have to rely on what the fluid that they're in is doing. So they move through the blood system. They can move through any kind of a fluid system that's moving, you know, or the lymph system. So you functionalize them to do what they are supposed to do when they arrive where they need to be. But otherwise, they're moving with the flow, really. And what you see also is when there's not that flow, you see Brownian motion. So Brownian motion just kind of jiggling things around at a local scale. So it's important for us to know how certain things do work at the nanoscale so that we can get these little bots to actually do what we want them to do. So we are now at our second breakout. We have to.
So I'm going to talk about quantum effects and how we can use quantum effects in practical applications. So our universe is discontinuous at a very small size scale, and different wavelengths of light are different individual colors, and we call those packets of light photons. And when light interacts with surfaces, we can get different effects. So the location of an electron around the nucleus of an atom is probabilistic in nature. So when you're teaching chemistry, you're probably used to seeing these pictures that show electrons orbiting around the nucleus. But what we know is that they're in discrete orbitals that have certain probability distributions around that nucleus. And there are a number of different quantum effects that you can get with these discrete particles. So on the right-hand side would be a classical example of like throwing a ball against a wall and the ball bounces back. But on the right-hand side, we've got a quantum picture. And what you can see in the top image is an example of an electron wave. And some of that electron wave could go on the other side of the wall due to the probability of the location of the electron. And so it could, in effect, tunnel underneath the wall. We take practical example of this in scanning tunneling microscopes, which are called STMs. And in a scanning tunneling microscope, a tip moves across the surface of a sample and a voltage is applied. And electrons will tunnel from the surface of the tip to the sample. And a current is measured, and that's used to produce an image. So on the right-hand side, this is a surface of graphite, 1 meter by 1 meter. And you can image down close to atomic resolution. But getting these pictures is really difficult. This is a super amazing publication quality picture. STM's pretty hard to get right. And we are currently in a phase of transistors moving down in size scale in research now anyway in the 3 nanometer size range. In the 3 nanometer process node. And we've got commercial transistors now that are in the 7 nanometer process node. So since 1950, when commercial transistors were invented, we've seen a steady decrease in the size of transistors in our electronics. But is there eventually going to be a limit? Apple's new chips are made on a 5 nanometer process, and the new AMD Ryzen chips, those are 7 nanometer process. And how much smaller are we going to be able to get those gates in the silicon? So potentially we're going to run into this problem where the transistors are going to get so small that the electrons will just tunnel through them. We haven't hit that limit yet, but we will get to this point of such small electronics that the electrons will just leak through from the source to the drain. So a new kind of quantum computing takes advantage of quantum effects. And these quantum computers, some of them are based on light, some of them are based on particles. The ones based on particles have to be chilled to incredibly low temperatures in order to decrease the Brownian motion of the particles so that their spins don't flip. And these types of computers are great at solving statistical type problems. Right now, IBM has a quantum computer, and you can even sign up for some use on IBM's quantum computer. So the way that the particle quantum computers work is that the bits, the particles in the computer could either be one of two states, up or down, and that two different particles could be entangled, and the state of one of those particles will affect the state of the other. So can a quantum computer do some things better than the computers we're using right now on this Zoom call? So some areas would be in cryptography, machine learning, designing drugs or materials, and sifting through big data. Those are all potential ways that we could use quantum computers. So I'm just going to preview our session next week because I'm excited to talk to you next week with my colleague Jared from the MNTEC, the Micro Nanotechnology Education Center. And we're going to talk about a whole bunch of nanotechnology applications. We'll talk about health and medicine applications, IT applications, energy, material science applications, food, and then characterization instrument applications. And for each one of those applications, we'll talk about how those things are made. So I really hope that everybody who's here today comes next week because we've got some really neat things to show you next week.